Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1-pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility, to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show where we explore the many methods of transformation and aim to mine a few nuggets of gold that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, even though sometimes it might feel counterintuitive, just like the nightingale, a bird that sings in the dark. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and I'm delighted to have you with me today. Today's show is brought to you in association with Nasal Guard, the drug-free nasal gel that uses electrostatic technology to block harmful airborne contaminants. It blocks indoor and outdoor allergens, so it's great for travellers as well as people with pet allergies. We'll hear more from Nasal Guard later in the show. First, we're featuring phobias and how to face and erase them. Many of us have phobias, some we don't even know about consciously. Regular listeners might have heard me talking about my hidden phobia, tocophobia, the fear of giving birth that has had a profound impact on my life, and I didn't have a clue it existed until the end of last year when I was able to deal with it and move on. You'll find that episode where I talk about it with Alexia Leachman on my show page here on ukhealthradio.com, and a video of the same interview is on my YouTube channel, Alternatively Speaking. Now, dealing with our fears and phobias can play a huge part in transforming our well-being, well, our lives, for the better, so I was very pleased to be able to chat with a world phobia expert about just that recently. Christopher Paul Jones is known as the breakthrough expert. He has a Harley Street practice where his client list includes a raft of celebrities and famous people from all over the world. Now he's brought out a book called Face Your Fears, 7 Steps to Conquering Phobias and Anxiety. When we talked, my first question for Chris was, what exactly is the difference between a phobia, a fear, and anxiety?
Okay, well, a phobia is basically an irrational response to something that doesn't require that response. So a fear, you know, if you are scared of something, for example, you know, there's a mad axe murderer trying to kill you. It's perfectly normal. I went dramatic there, you know. It's perfectly normal to either want to fight back, you know, punch the person, or if you think you can't win the fight, you run. Or if you think you can't run and you can't beat the person, you're going to freeze. So you basically play dead, play possum. These are perfectly normal responses to survival. A phobia is where your brain has made that same link to something that isn't particularly dangerous. And so, for example, Pavlov's dog. So the early days of psychology, there was a Russian research scientist. What he'd do, he'd ring a bell, tuning fork, feed a dog, ring a bell, feed the dog. Eventually, the bell rings, the dog salivates like it's about to be fed. Now, the two have nothing in common, but the mind makes the two the same, and human beings do the same thing. So the common analogy is if you're kissing the love of your life and you hear a piece of music playing, you could hear that tune 2, 3, 10 years later, and if the emotions are strong enough, you're back there feeling those feelings. Hear a piece of music playing, the love of your life is breaking up with you, you can hear that tune 2, 3, 10 years later, be back there crying. And so what's happened with a phobia, at some point in your past, your brain has gone, this thing equals danger. And so you're 8 years old, you have a turbulent flight, your brain goes, oh, that was scary. and it links that conditioning. And this can be anything. And this is why people can have phobias of water or balloons, or, you know, one client fear of tinsel, because their brain has just associated danger while seeing that thing. So that's what a phobia is. It's not always that directly linked, though. And so, for example, some phobias, fear of not being able to escape, for example, claustrophobia or agoraphobia. Yes, that can be, you once got trapped in a public toilet when you were four and couldn't open the door and panicked, you know, this kind of thing. But it could also be you felt emotionally trapped. And so if your parents, say, argued all the time and you're young and lying in bed and got nowhere to go, that can also create this sort of claustrophobia. But whatever it is, there will be something in your past that's triggered that, or watching a news story, hearing someone else tell you something. Sometimes you're just, for whatever reason, these beliefs go in deep and it ends up shaping your whole reality.
Yeah, you went for the really horrific example. I was thinking of, you know, walking along a path and suddenly seeing a poisonous snake, and then you
Absolutely.
Feel that fear. And
yes,
but, you know, not quite as dramatic as yours. But
yeah.
Then you are catapulted into your fight or flight mode,
yeah.
And you run. You get
yes.
out of the way. So,
yes.
And that's a good thing. But phobias, they can absolutely cripple somebody. They can be really debilitating, can't they? I mean, especially
yeah.
things like, a common one is fear of flying, obviously.
Yes.
And that, I guess, can have various origins. Like maybe if you've been in a particularly traumatic flight where, you know, it's been really, really bumpy and the cabin pressure maybe got lost from, you know, all of that kind of stuff,
yeah.
then you can, that's understandable. But aren't there other phobias which you maybe don't even realize what the origins of those might be? And you don't even know that you've got a phobia sometimes.
Yes. Yeah.
They do exist, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. And so things, it's almost like those ones, like fear of flying or spiders or something, are sometimes more obvious. And, you know, as you were saying, you've shared on your channel,
yeah,
your phobias, and those ones that lay hidden. And it's like fear of success or fear of failure. You know, sometimes you overhear the conversation when you're younger of people being mean to someone who's successful, you know, and you go, oh, you never want to be too successful, or they'll try and pull you down, you know. And so then you create, you could call it a phobia or a fear, but you create a fear of success. And so you get so far in where you're going in life, and then suddenly you'll start sabotaging. And so, you know, question I get asked all the time when I do talks or interviews or whatever is, do I have any phobias? And of course, my answer to that is no, of course not. I'm perfect. jokingly, obviously.
Yeah.
But and what I would say with non-jokingly is I'm going to imagine I still have some, although all the big ones I've covered. But if there's something you want in life and you haven't quite got it yet, as long as you've set a realistic enough goal. And so if you find yourself sabotaging, there's probably some level of phobia or fear there that's influencing you. So if you know you're limited, but you're not sure what, then it's worth looking at that and looking
yeah.
at what's behind that.
Yeah. And talking about your own phobias and whether you've got any, what brought you to this line of work? How did you come
right.
to specialize in this?
Right. So I used to, I had fear of public speaking, and I had fear of flying, and I did have fear of wasps as well, and a few other things,
yeah.
social phobias. Basically, I used to be a cameraman many, many years ago in my old life. And back before they had drones, I was on a helicopter and I was filming these people coming down, snowboarding down the mountain. It was great, you know, great experience. Anyway, so it was the last day of this filming and for this documentary, we returned home. And then I find out that half an hour later, that helicopter had crashed into a mountain.
Oh.
And so that had created a pretty strong fear. Now, again, the logical argument is, well, half an hour, a day, a year, a life, what difference does it make? You know, but on the emotional level, it kind of hardwired that fear. And, you know, I'd had a fear from reading in public for quite a long time, speaking in public, because growing up, I was labeled dyslexic, which means you mix up words and, you know, you're not a great speller or a great reader. And I was forced to read in front of the class and everyone laughed at me. And then I was like, never, ever speak. So I got interested in sort of personal development. I ended up filming for one of the top people in personal improvement. And I watched him sort of removing phobias and doing all these other things. And I was like, I want to learn that. And really, it was just for myself. And it so happened at the time that two people that were there on the course said, oh, we need someone to do filming for our courses. And I was like, well, you know, let me trade you, basically. And so that's how I first got into it. And so I started learning some of these tools for myself on the courses, and I spoke to, you know, professionals. And then over time I studied, you know, lots of different things. So I started with what's called NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. And then I looked at other things, the tapping, eye movement processes like EMDR, these kind of things, hypnotherapy. And then, you know, conventional things as well, like cognitive behavioral therapy and contemporary psychotherapy. So I kind of covered the whole range of tools. And then over time, by working on myself and working with people, I kind of found my own path, really, my own approach to help other people. And then I started helping other people and over time perfecting that. And then that became my full-time job. And now I'm here today, you know, at Harley Street, you know, been on the BBC doing all these things, right?
World,
you know,
expert.
New book out.
World yes, expert.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but yeah. I originally did it for myself because I had my fears. And then I thought, well, you know, maybe I have something to add to other people, really.
It's so interesting, isn't it? So many people I interview have got into doing what they're doing in terms of well-being because they had to get through their own hurdles of well-being to get to where they are. And then they thought, oh, well, I'm going to give back now. This is what I can do for other people. It's very, very interesting how that happens. But absolutely. I'm interested as well, you know, the helicopter thing, it's so interesting. I remember years ago being in New York and taking one of those sightseeing helicopter rides up and really enjoyed it. Spoke to somebody later that day, a local person in New York, and they said, you know how many of those go down in the Hudson? And I went, oh. But it didn't quite put me off because I didn't make that association. Now, I don't think I'll ever go up in a microlight again because I was in Southern Africa. We were at Victoria Falls on the Zambia side. And I spent virtually the entire flight with my eyes closed, saying,
right.
Yes. Please let me be safe, please. And my fists literally clenched on whatever it was in front of me, saying, please let me be safe. And the pilot was saying, oh, look down there. You can see all the hippos. And no, I'm not looking anywhere. I'm not looking down there. Yeah. Cannot look down there. So the whole thing was wasted on me. But it had the opposite effect on me, funnily enough, because then I thought, well, if I can do that, I can do anything.
Yes. Well, that is, you know, that is true that sometimes what would be an example, when I'd already worked on the public speaking, but as I got better, one of the things they sometimes do with public speaking is go, right, now get up and present your script like you're a Marilyn Monroe or you're an American wrestler or something. And of course, once you've done that, just delivering it normal is easier. And so there's, you know, what would be an example? Someone like Tony Robbins, for example, who does these firewalks. I mean, he's doing more online now. But, you know, when he shows that video of the big flames coming up, everyone's like, oh, my God. But then when you show it and it's just some hot coals, it feels easy by comparison, you know, to anyone who's done it only after the fact, not before. And so it's the same, really. But there are lots of people, though, who do that, who think just, oh, if I just expose myself, you know, if I just go, you know, I don't know, if I just parachute out of a plane, then I'll somehow be better. For some people, it will make a lot worse. And so it's stretching that comfort zone in a way that's not overwhelming. And, you know, my issue with sort of CBT exposure therapy on its own, of course, you have to test the fear, is that it can be quite tense. You know, you're constantly having to battle through your fear. It feels like you're in the army or something, constantly having to man up and face it. And there's lots of tools available today where you can take out that emotional charge fairly easy. So challenging yourself becomes a lot easier and a lot more effortless. So that's the only thing I would say about that. Yes, for some people, it's a good thing. Other people, it can be overwhelming, and everybody's different, you know.
Absolutely. Everybody's different. And I still don't think I'll ever go up in a microlight again.
Well, we can, off camera, maybe we can see what we can do. But again,
but do I need to? You know, I don't need to.
Right. And this is the point. Someone asked me this yesterday. They were going, well, what's the most common fears you deal with? And I said, and then they said, what's the most common fears? And it's like, they're two different things. So the person who is like, there's certain fears that you go, no, I have to get up. So like flying, okay, I don't get to go on holiday with my family or see the world or whatever. It's quite a limiting one. You know, public speaking, you know, career-wise, especially as, you know, depending on the level of public speaking, everything, a lot of things are done on Zoom, meetings, whatever. So it can be very inhibiting. Things like clowns, a lot of people have that, but they can avoid McDonald's. They can avoid going to the circus. It's not necessarily life-altering to avoid those phobias. So yes, it is how much impact is it having in your daily life. All I'll say is this, if there's something that has, if you're making a decision from fear, it's probably a limiting one. And so the question is, do you need to have that fear as well? Do you need to face it? No, but do you need to have that fear? And so when people come to me, for example, and say, oh, you know, I just love my own company. Well, that's wonderful. But if what they mean is, I love my own company because if I'm around other people, I might get judged. That's a decision from fear. And the true is also, it's true in reverse. If someone's going, you know, oh, I absolutely love being around people. Great. But if they're saying I have to be around people because if I'm alone, I start getting in my own head and worrying and whatever. So it's always, is the decision from choice or fear? And if the choice is from fear, what is it that's worth working on to improve my life?
Yeah, I can understand that. I can. Mm. And, you know, I'm thinking about the microlight example and, you know, maybe I would go up in a microlight again, but maybe if we weren't going so high and, you know, and it wasn't so dramatic and having done it once, I would know what to expect as well. So there is a difference again between a phobia, fear, and stress and anxiety, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah. So a lot of people use the term anxiety and stress interchangeably. And I forget who said it, but it's like stress is almost like the acceptable corporate word for anxiety, you know, but they are very different. I mean, anxiety, while the root cause will be, there will be something in your past, it tends not to be so specific. It tends not to be a trigger. It tends to be more a prolonged period of being fearful. So, you know, again, commonly childhood, as I said, if you had parents fighting all the time or you just felt unstable, anything that where you're in a prolonged parents going through divorce, being bullied at school, this kind of thing will create a belief that you're not safe, basically. And then, as I say, your fight, flight or freeze becomes overclocked. So you start dealing with it as anything out your comfort zone. And so someone who has anxiety is likely also to create a lot of phobias, but it's the core belief is often something like, I'm not safe in the world, or I can't trust people or something like that, rather than flying or confined spaces or something very specific. So yeah, anxiety tends to be much more general. Stress tends to be that same emotion, but linked to a specific outcome. And so stress is, you know, I've got a deadline, you know, got this project to finish. And so if it's stress, not anxiety, once that deadline is reached, then the body will go, ah. When people who are anxious tend to, it's a bit like playing whack-a-mole. The mind will sit up, right, now I need to find something else to worry about. You know, well, what else can I latch onto? Because if I'm not worrying, then somehow I'm not prepared or safe, which, you know, leads into what we call secondary gain, the benefit for holding onto the problem.
So there you go. More on all of that later. First, it's time to hear these messages back right after this short break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and my special guest today, phobias expert Christopher Paul Jones. Now, we talked about the difference between phobias, fears, and anxieties before the break, but there's something a lot of people don't realise here, and it's that these things can be dealt with very easily.
Yes. So, and a lot of people come to me and go, you know, how is it possible to change someone who's had a phobia for 30 years and, you know, whatever, in one session? And it doesn't always take one session, it depends on the issue. And the analogy I often give is, if you imagine, you're a dog lover, dog lover, dog lover, dog lover. I am a dog lover. And then one day you got your hand bitten off by a dog. How quick would you go from love to fear? Or you're in love, find out your partner's cheating on you. How quickly would you go from love to anger or love to hate, you know, potentially? And so the brain learns incredibly quickly with enough negative association. And so with enough positive association, it can also go from fear to calmness, fear to joy, fear to happiness. So as I say, the key is finding those triggers, finding those Pavlovian responses and doing various processes to desensitize it. That's kind of the first step, really. And I think a lot of people don't really know what they're afraid of as well. So going back to flying, you know, that's a prime example of many different fears. Some people are scared of the heights. Some people are scared of the movement. Some people are scared of being confined. Some people are scared of being far from home. Some people are obviously scared of crashing. So they're dying, basically. So there's many different fears that can make up one phobia. And as human beings, we spend most of our time living in a logical mind, you know, what you maybe call the conscious mind. As opposed, and emotions aren't logical and they come from, you know, the subconscious. And so it's learning how to talk the language of emotion, basically, and working with that, which we don't really do very often as people.
No, we don't. And it, as we've said already, it can be extremely debilitating if you have a phobia. Yes. And, you know, even just something like not being able to go on holiday with your family because you're scared of flying, it can be impactful in terms of your health and well-being. And, you know, I actually have a friend here, and she is scared of flying, and it's directly as a result of having a very, very bumpy ride in a plane, yeah, you know, plane journey one time, and now she won't go near an aeroplane.
Right.
Now, I have said to her, but, you know, you don't have to live with that.
Mm.
But she doesn't accept that. Do you get people, I mean, obviously people who come to you want to deal with their phobias, but what about the people who sort of know that they're phobic but kind of won't accept that there's anything you can do about it?
A couple of things with that. And I think, so bearing in mind, before I discovered the stuff I do now, I guess we're going back 20 years ago now, I thought that how you solved a problem was to sit talk about your childhood for the next 20 years. That was my idea of what therapy was. And I'm sure there is a place for that sort of talking backwards and forwards, but it's not the same as dealing with the emotional component. So I think that's the first thing. People don't know that these tools exist. But I think the other element, and I started to touch on it in the last section, which was secondary gain.
Yeah.
Everything we are doing, however illogical, however irrational, is meeting a need. Now, that sounds silly, but if you think about it, with something like fears, phobias, anxiety, often the brain thinks fear is what protects me. Fear is what makes me ready for battle, you know, keeps me safe, avoid danger. And so what happens sometimes when someone thinks they're going to, you know, an intervention type therapist, oh, we're going to take away your fear, the analytical mind is going, well, that's good. The emotional mind is going, but how will I be safe, ready, or prepared? And the analogy I use is, imagine you're in a burning building and someone comes to you and goes, hey, do you want to feel nice and relaxed in this burning building? The mind goes, no, I need to get the hell out of here. So it's teaching that subconscious that the thing it thinks it's doing is probably not doing it in a particularly well way, or at least in the context. And so our brains are very good or bad at what you call generalizing. And so this is where you take one experience and assume that it's always going to be that way. And it's a perfectly good response. So you touch a hot stove when you're young, you know not to touch a hot stove again in future, no matter where the stove is. Hot surfaces, stay away from, you know. But when you've had a bad experience, like say, turbulent flight, your brain has generalized, this is dangerous. So you're constantly firing off that response. And as I say, if you're in fight, flight, or freeze, you're ready for battle, you're ready to run, you're ready to hide. And there's a part of the mind that thinks ripping the seat is keeping the plane in the air, even though you know logically it's not. And so the first question would be, does this person know that there are very quick tools and that they don't have to face that fear to let it go? There are ways of letting it go first, so you no longer have to feel it. And also, what need is this behavior meeting? Now, the other one with secondary gain that sometimes comes up, especially anxiety, it's like a weird comfort blanket. You know, it's like this keeps this like familiar, and it's a bit, I guess it's a bit like being in an abusive relationship. You know, it's familiar, but it's not good. And so, when you've had a pattern of thinking and feeling for so long, often the mind starts to go, who am I without this? Maybe I wouldn't recognize myself. Maybe. And so there's all sorts of beliefs, as I say, that don't make logical sense, that can hold up these fears and these patterns of thinking.
Yeah. And that also makes me think of people who have to be ill in order to
absolutely
be somewhere. A lot of people, you know, they identify themselves through their illness.
Yes, absolutely.
And where would they be if they weren't ill?
Yes. And people who always seem to have drama. And at some point in their past, especially, so if they didn't get love from very often from other sources, their brain goes, when I hurt myself, you know, my dad was there or my mom was there or I felt loved. And so, again, people aren't necessarily consciously doing that for the most part, but there's a part of them going, problems get me love. Problems get me noticed. Problems get. And so if your brain can't find good ways to meet that need, it will find negative ways. And I guess that's a bit like the stereotype of the younger child. The older child stereotypically tends to be the pleaser. The younger child goes, well, that role's taken. How am I going to get attention? Well, I'll act up then. I'll be the rebel. I'll be the black sheep, you know. And so it's a bit like that with our emotions. It's so there's all sorts of things that can make the secondary gain and again, we don't think about these things.
No, we don't. And I was just thinking, I'm the younger child and somebody called me the black sheep of the family, and I was quite offended. I thought, really, am I? Maybe.
But you tend to be more the younger. I'm the youngest too, by the way. They tend to also, so I'm going to compliment youngest, even though I'm sure my parents would have said I was a pain in the ass. They tend to be more rebellious. They tend to go against the grain and you know, come up with new ideas and things. So there is an advantage sometimes. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but
we're
always trying to define ourselves. And if we can't be defined for our achievements, we'll often be defined for our problems, you know.
It's a very, very, very good point. And, you know, we're talking again about how we get through or get over these phobias, fears, etc. And of course, your book is called Face Your Fears, 7 Steps to Conquering Phobias and Anxiety. I have it there. Yes. So what are the 7 steps? Can you tell us here now?
Sure.
Or
I can give you the brief overview.
Yeah.
So
give us a headline.
And some of it, we'll come back to what we've said. So the first step, really, step one is getting precision on the problem. And that's kind of to my point. A lot of people don't know what they're afraid of. And so it's getting very clear on exactly what you do to be afraid. And so one of the lines I would use with the client is, teach me how to be afraid. I don't know how to do your phobia. Teach me how to do it. So what does the person have to picture, feel, focus on, believe in order to feel that way? Because without us knowing it, there's a recipe to how we feel. And so the first thing is acknowledging that. The second thing is then getting out of your head. Because as I say, why asking yourself why and, you know, psychoanalyzing yourself isn't necessarily always bad. It doesn't necessarily get to the emotions. And so then it's about, and, you know, self-hypnosis, mindfulness, these various techniques that can just get you more in touch with your inner world, somatic work, these kind of things. And then step three is about finding that strategy and actually how to unpick it. And so there are various processes to desensitize yourself, to change those patterns of thinking and feeling. So as I sort of reconditioning tools, what's called anchoring, sort of scrambling tools, things that are like what's called the rewind process or fast phobia and other methodologies, Kindline therapy, all these things that basically take out the emotional response. Eye movement processes and self-soothing processes, which are what's called bilateral stimulation. So there's many different methods to actually take out the emotional charge. Then the other step is about dealing with the secondary gain, which I've talked about. You know, what is the belief? What is the emotion? What is the underlying need that's trying to be met by this? And, you know, a lot of therapists say, oh, that client wasn't ready to change. And I'm always like, well, that may be true, but the question is, what's the belief that makes the person not ready to change? And when you can work on that, often it becomes easier. Then you've got focusing on, basically, I've lost my steps at this point.
Where were we? I think we're on 4. Are we on 4?
4. Yeah. So that was 4. That was 4. It was 3, then 4. So 3 is the secondary gain. 4 is sort of unpicking the strategy. And then 5 is sort of... 5 and 6 are about reconditioning the positive, basically. So just like we've created conditioning, you know, Pavlovian conditioning to feel bad, there's various ways to feel good. And so if you link enough pleasure to something, you can completely reverse how you feel. So there was, you know, there was one person I was working with, had a fear of turbulence, and we had 10 minutes left of the session. And so all I did was a reconditioning technique where I went, okay, think about turbulence, think about your best kiss. Think about turbulence, think about your best kiss. I think they were thinking of something a bit more intimate than their best kiss.
Yes, but we're
going for that, yeah. Anyway, so I'm speaking to the person that they mailed me a couple of months later and said, oh, I'm sitting on the plane waiting for turbulence. And I was like, oh, don't worry about it. You know, we hadn't got much time. There's plenty of other processes we can do. And they were like, no, you don't understand. I really enjoy turbulence now, put it that way. And so, yeah, with enough pleasure, you can completely change how you feel. And then step 7 is about focusing on that positive future. And so this is very common with anxiety, where you're basically imagining something that hasn't even happened yet and imagining it like it's a horror movie. So someone who has a fear of spiders is imagining them around every corner. Someone who has a fear of flying, yeah, they're already imagining, say, oh, I've got a flight in a day, week's time. And it's like, okay, picture that flight. Are you imagining yourself calmly looking out the window going, oh, I'm soaring like an eagle? Or are you already planning that horror movie? And so it's also working on those what ifs and yeah buts, which is, you know, what if I get scared? What if I get anxious? Because that's the other thing that goes with anxiety. It's a lot of fear of being fearful, which is, it's either a fear of embarrassing yourself. What if I freak out and embarrass myself? Or it's a fear of the emotion itself. And of course, the irony is that self-fulfilling. So if you go, maybe I'll panic, maybe I won't, life goes on. If you go, what if I panic? What if I panic? What if I get anxious? See, I was right to worry. I'm getting anxious. We don't realize we're feeding that. And so it's also dealing with the future. And most, like, for example, there's lots of schools of hypnotherapy. And some deal with the future. Some deal with the past. Some, you know, do more what you call like mindfulness. And really, you kind of need to touch everything. So past, present, future, and secondary gain, you know, underlying sort of cement or roots that hold this fear in place.
And that secondary gain can be very powerful. Stay tuned for more on that in a moment, right after another short break. Back right after this.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back. You're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. I'm JJ, the practical alchemist, and my guest today is the Harley Street phobias expert, Christopher Paul Jones. We were talking about secondary gain before the break, and I recalled my own NLP training and how powerful we understood that to be.
Yeah, and I think the secondary gain thing is much more powerful than people realise.
Yes.
I know that, I did a similar, I've done similar training to you in the past. And and I remember the whole secondary gain thing when we were talking about addiction. So, what is this? There's always a secondary gain. So people giving up smoking, they know it's bad for them, but there's a secondary gain.
Yes.
And when you get to that, when you know what that is, you can help people give up smoking.
Yes.
And that secondary gain is hugely powerful.
Yes. And often it comes into often two categories. One is the belief that it's relaxing you. And two, if you trace people back to the sort of root cause, it's often, I felt cool. I felt one of the gang. I felt like a rebel. You know, I was included. If I was in with the bad boy smoking or the bad girl smoking, you know, somehow I'm included. And so there's all these sort of things that can go in place we're still kind of reliving those memories. You know, it doesn't matter how old we are. We're going back to that teenager. We're going back to that 4-year-old that got scared. We're going back to that 2-year-old. That's the other thing, actually, I would say. The problem with trying to use logic is you're often trying to solve it from the age you are now rather than the age at which you created it. And so, and I talk about this in the book, if you're 2 years old and you get lost in a supermarket, it could have only been for a couple of minutes. But one, at 2 years old, a couple of minutes is a long time. You've only been alive 2 years. Two, you don't know it was going to be 2 minutes and everything looks tall and massive. So, you know, just like when you were a kid, you might be scared of the dark or monsters under the bed or whatever. So it's and your emotional mind, your subconscious tends to be the age of a sort of 6 or 7 year old. It doesn't tend to be the age of an adult. So you're still thinking like a child when it comes to the emotion or feeling like a child.
I think that's a really good point, actually. Yeah, it's you know, not trying to solve a problem from where you are, but going back to where the problem began and solving it from that perspective. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, you know, a lot of people, we talk about the fear of public speaking and that sort of thing. I mean, I've known a lot of people who take beta blockers before they have to, you know, go and talk to, you know, do a town hall if they're in a corporate world. And of course, what we're talking about here are ways of dealing with these issues, these mental issues, these debilitating issues without resorting to drugs.
Yes, absolutely. And again, you know, one of my mentors once said, you know, saying drugs are never the answer is like saying drugs are always the answer. Both are equally as silly, you know. But things like fears and phobias, there are many ways to deal with it. Now, maybe you need the medication to get to that place, but I don't think it should be the first port of call, really. There are plenty of tools that people aren't aware of for taking out the emotional charge. Public speaking is an interesting one because it's one of the top phobias. You look at any list of phobias, it comes up very
death,
high.
Death, public speaking, and what's the other one? Yes. Yeah, taxes or something, I don't know.
Yeah. And yet, it's the one phobia. So you go, okay, fear of spiders. Yeah, not likely to in the UK, but in other cultures, maybe you could get hurt, you know.
Yeah.
You know, flying very, you know, much safer than sleeping in your own bed statistically, but it's not that plane crashes have never happened. So there is some, and often, you know, if people are scared of the crashing, they're focusing on that 9/11, they're focusing on Lockerbie, they're focusing on, or even on the movie they saw, which is fictional, but they're, because the thing about Hollywood is planes are a very good shorthand. A plane crash is a very good shorthand to get you with a bunch of strangers in a strange place. So they use it all the time. And, you know, I talk about this. I was like, yeah, but if you were to go by what movies do, then everyone in your village would have had amnesia at some point. You know, if you look at a soap opera. Yeah, I've never met anyone with amnesia, but it happens all the time in movies and TV. But public speaking, the worst case scenario is you forget your line and feel slightly embarrassed. The word
Correct.
That's yet there's something about the social aspect of being in the spotlight, of being singled out, that is incredibly terrifying for people. And so, yeah, it's amazing how much of a grip that has on people. And yet there's no, even at the worst case scenario, even at the most absurd, it didn't go well. I felt a bit embarrassed, you know. But it consumed me for many years, like I said. And one of the good things going to sort of drugs or alcohol or whatever is that when I was a student, I did that. I'd say, oh, what do you do when you're nervous? Oh, you drink whiskey. And I because I didn't know, so I drank whiskey. No, I still feel nervous. All right, drink more. And anyway.
Well, we know where that ends.
Yeah. It was so bad that a friend of mine said, don't worry, I'll ask lots of questions when you get up there. And I got up and I spoke for about 2 minutes. And I said, why don't you ask me any questions to my friend afterwards? He said, I had no idea what he was saying. So luckily, my attempts to medicate made me go, no, that's not the way to solve it. So, luckily, there are many tools that can just, you know, deal with the past, but in the moment to make you feel very, to change your perception without needing drugs or alcohol or anything like that.
Yeah, which is what I always aspire to. I think, you know, that's the way forward if we can do it. I don't say that, you know, you never take any pharmaceuticals because sometimes it will help you get on your way.
Yes. And I think that's it, using it as not the first resort, but if there's no other way, and using it as a way to make it easier to work on it, not a way to just keep medicating yourself over and over again.
Exactly, exactly. Well, listen, I'm so glad that you have joined me today for this. It's been really good to speak with you. And your book is, again, Face Your Fears, 7 Steps to Conquering Phobias and Anxiety. And if anybody wants to have your personal help conquering their fears and their phobias, where do they get in touch with you?
Okay, so they can go to christopherpauljones.com and there's a place there to book like a complimentary 30-minute chat, so we can talk about that. And it also has, you know, other links and resources and videos and things to help people. So
I love it. That's fantastic. Well, Chris, thank you so much. And
you're very welcome.
All the best with the book. And yeah, it's really good to hear. I mean, I think people don't realize enough generally that we can get through these really debilitating fears and anxieties and phobias without too much hassle, really. I mean, you can get through them easily and live a much more productive, happy, generative life.
Absolutely. So, yes.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Fantastic. And if you've been inspired to face your own fears and conquer them, do check out Chris's book to help you do just that. Nobody deserves to live a life debilitated by allergies either. We're coming into hay fever season now here in the UK, which brings misery to millions, but it doesn't have to. Nasal Guard is a discreet gel that helps people who suffer from pollen and pet allergies. It's also great for travellers by keeping pollution and virus-sized airborne particles out of our system. Here's Nasal Guard's co-founder and co-inventor, Kanika Vahi, to tell us all about the product.
Nasal Guard works just as simple as a basic magnet. As you know, like charges repel each other and opposite charges attract each other. Our nasal guard gel is a positively charged gel that attracts negatively charged airborne particles onto the nose, essentially creating an electrostatic barrier and invisible shield prior to inhalation and right around your upper lip and your nostril and nasal area. So it helps block out a lot of the pesky and dirty air particles that you see floating around. It's safe for the entire family, and we pride ourselves in the fact that it works on very simple physics. The majority of particles that are contributing to a lot of the respiratory symptoms are inhaled through the nose rather than the mouth. So while it's not directed or instructed to be applied, or our topical gel is not instructed to be applied around the nose or around the mouth, rather, it does have a large contribution of blocking and stopping those particles, the airborne particles, from being inhaled through the nasal passages. The majority of the harmful particles are the reason why, and the reason why people have the majority of the symptoms, such as runny nose or itchy eyes, coughing, sneezing. They're all due to the fact that they are inhaling some of these either pollen or dust mites, pet dander. Some of the hay fever symptoms are directly correlated with that. We like to think that it's universally beneficial because everyone has a nose, everyone breathes. We do believe that it's universally beneficial across the board. The best selling product so far has been the air travelers segment, followed by the pet lovers. But I will say that there are quite a few school children, parents who buy this for, you know, their entire family. You know, they themselves might be a germaphobe. They would like to pass this on to their kids and make sure they're applying this to help protect themselves and to help block out some of the pesky, dirty airborne particles that are floating around in majority of daycare or schools. We find that a lot of law enforcement, even whether it's a firefighter, some police officers, they are a lot of our repeat customers. Some people who like to garden or tend to a lawn, they've found, you know, major relief and major benefit from the product line because they're able to resume their regular life and daily activities without being bogged down by, you know, sneezing and watery eyes. They are able to enjoy their garden in peace. There are quite a few parents who have given us feedback, even teachers who have found us on social media and talk about their own experiences completely organically. They love to spread awareness that there are measures that you can take that don't involve antihistamines or products like Benadryl there are options that you can take control of and actually prevent rather than cure. We like to instruct and we like to direct our customers to use common sense. And also if they're sweating or getting their nose wet or taking a shower or going for a swim, we like to make sure that they understand that it does need to be reapplied as necessary. And that does include when you're going for a swim. And like I said, if you're working out and sweating it off, you typically would have to be reapplying it. Or if you're blowing your nose, you typically would reapply it afterwards. So that is something to keep in mind. It is a water-based gel, all clean ingredients. We'd like to make sure that people understand that there should not be any drug interactions with any prescription medication. It is over-the-counter and there are no active ingredients. But we do want to make sure that customers understand that there is reapplication every 4 to 6 hours or as often as needed. You just need a pin-sized drop. I can demo that. It's very easy. You simply take a pin-sized drop, the tiniest amount, and actually for this, less is more. You want to make sure it's an even application around the nostrils and right around the base of the nose and the upper lip, and you're good to go. It's very easy. All of the ingredients are cosmetic-grade ingredients, so they're safe to use under or over makeup, and we like to consider it our sunscreen because it's obviously meant to be before exposure to or before entering any sort of environment or polluted area. It has to be applied prior to rather than after the fact. So we consider it our sunscreen.
Kanika Vahi there to tell us all about this ingenious product. If you want to try Nasal Guard for yourself, just click on the link on the UK Health Radio homepage for worldwide delivery. And that just about brings us to the end of today's show, brought to you in association with Nasal Guard, the drug-free nasal gel that uses electrostatic technology to block harmful airborne contaminants as well as indoor and outdoor allergens. If you want to find out more about me, then do check out my websites, thepracticalalchemist.uk and also safehavenhealing.uk. That's where you'll find out all about my energy clearing work. You'll find all the links to my social media channels at my websites as well, and my YouTube channel, my new YouTube channel, Alternatively Speaking. Do check that out too. For now though, there's just time to say thank you for listening. Join me next time for more Practical Alchemy. Until then, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.